more about that tonight. But this member has been with us since January 21st of 1987. So if we could give a warm Valley Group welcome to Carl M. of Covina.
Thank you, Jim. My name is Carl. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not sure whose uncle you are, but it was nice chatting with you earlier tonight, and I am indeed from Covina. And we are, our home group is also called Covina, and our city is called Covina. So we are quite clever in our naming of our home group, to name it the Covina group. So anyway, as Jim had said, my sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous in handcuffs at 25 years old. I have not left you. I have not left Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never not been an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous since day one. I was forced into it in the beginning. I was forced by the military, believe it or not. I was in handcuffs by the military, thrown into a military treatment center, and I was forced to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's sort of like, and in fact, in the beginning, I got to tell you this, you know, they would take us in vans from the military treatment center out to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of us had some pretty serious charges hanging over our heads in our early sobriety. And quite often, almost every night, our van would also have an armed guard with us. And they would actually, this is the late 80s when everybody could still smoke in meetings. And we'd be at these large San Diego County meetings, and the military men and women would be sitting in the back, you know, some paying attention, some not. But the armed guard would always stand at the door, and he'd always have his jacket back so you could see his weapon on his side. And he'd be sitting there smoking a cigarette, watching us see if anyone was going to take off. And we stayed in our seat. I mean, when he would show us that weapon, we would stay in our seat. I guess that's some sort of version of strong sponsorship or something like that. You know, I'm not endorsing that we should get sponsors that are armed sitting in meetings telling newcomers to stay in their seat. I'm not endorsing that at all. That I'm just telling you my experience back in 1987. Anyway, I'm grateful to be here. You know, there's a lot of things in my life here at 34 years sober that I think are really important. That, just one second, my ex-wife keeps trying to FaceTime me here. It goes onto my iPad, and I'm going to tell her that I'm on a Zoom meeting. All right. So, there's a lot of things that I think are important. One of them being a dad, right? Being a good ex-husband. Paying attention to my business, paying attention to my community, paying attention to other family members, being a good son when my parents were still alive. All those things are really, really important and make up a lot about who I want to be as a man. But there is nothing that is more important than the very first sentence that I said when I got on. And that's not thanks, Uncle Jim. It was, my name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. That's the most important thing that I can say on any given day. Bar none, that is the most important thing. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is very simple. It's not complicated at all. Before I get going, I really want to say hi to New Hope and New Visions. It's really great to see houses on here, and I love it that you're waving back. Good for you. Good for you. You're actually paying attention. I love that. You know, all the other old guys on here do not excite me, but new people excite me, make it all worthwhile. I like other old guys. I'm one of them. Don't get me wrong. I'm one of them. But I just love new people in AA, so I'm glad you guys are here. Good job at the reading over there at New Hope. So, the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a really bizarre relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm alcoholic. Now, I might be weird in a number of other areas, but it's not because I'm alcoholic, right? I'm just weird because human beings are weird. Everybody's got weird, quirky stuff and stuff from their background and all this type of stuff. But the reason I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a bizarre relationship with alcohol. And the strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A really strange thing happens when I drink booze, and our book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink it is what they refer to as something called the phenomenon of craving. Phenomenon meaning unexplained. Don't really know why. Yeah, I know. In the last few years, science thinks they've been able to explain what enzyme we're missing and our liver's not processing it properly and we have this little, you know, whatever. Still, pretty much unexplained. This phenomenon of craving. The best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It's really strange. It happens with nothing else that I drink. An example of that. I've got this bottle of water right here, right? And over the next 40 minutes to 4 hours that I'm talking with you, you know, Bill just went, I'm not staying 4 hours. You'll be talking to yourself, Carl. But over the next 40 minutes that I'm talking with you, I'm going to drink about half of that maybe. And before I go to bed, I'll probably finish the bottle of water. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish that bottle of water, I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in a cheap motel room. Right? There is no chance that 3 a.m. I'm going to be texting a friend of mine. Hey, I need another case. Come on, man. I need another case. You know, I won't be in there naked with a bunch of people I don't even like peering out through the blinds in the cheap motel room. It's not going to happen. Right? But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical response, the fact that I lose control once I drink, if that was the sum total of my strange relationship with alcohol, well then, stop. Just stop. Nancy Reagan would be a hero when she came out and said, just say no. Right? If that would have worked, I would have. And I imagine you would have, at the first sign of trouble, gone, no. And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life, just saying no. But you see, I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol. And what's really strange about this part of my relationship with alcohol is that this happens when I'm not drinking. You see, bad things that happen when I drink are a drinking problem. But you see, I have alcoholism. Yes, I've got that drinking problem, but I've got more than that. I've got this thing that they call the mental obsession. That when I'm not drinking, I seem to have a mind that will always rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. My mind will always paint a picture to make it okay for me to drink again, no matter how much pain and suffering my last drunk may have caused for you or me. So therefore, because of these two aspects or components of my relationship with alcohol, number one, I cannot drink successfully because of this bizarre physical reaction that I get, the fact that I crave, I lose control. So I can't drink successfully. But at the very same time, I cannot not drink successfully because of this thing the book calls the mental obsession. They also refer to it as the strange mental blank spot, the thought process that precedes the first drink. Right? So because of these two things, I'm in the ultimate catch 22. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch 22 we call alcoholism. So I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, either drink successfully or on my own not drink successfully, that's what I'd be doing tonight. Actually, I just lied. And I think there's a woman named Tammy that was communicating with me before. I don't think she's on the meeting. But I think one of her text messages said, Carl, don't lie. And now I've just done that. I've just lied. Because I told you I would drink successfully if I could. And the truth is, I have no interest in drinking successfully. I really don't. Now, I used to think that I wanted to drink successfully, but I was ill-informed as to what drinking successfully actually was. And let's see if you have the illusion that maybe you want to drink successfully. Maybe you might be like I was and might not have all the information. See, the reason I didn't have the information as to what drinking successfully was is because I had never done it. I'd never done it. And now after 34 years of sobriety, I have found out through reading, I've read about it, and I've witnessed it in other people a number of times, So now I'm going to share with you, if you're new or fairly new, what apparently drinking successfully is, and let's see if you have any interest in that. Apparently, drinking successfully entails drinking approximately 2 drinks and stopping. Let that idea sink in. Let that idea sink in and let it settle right there in your alcoholic heart. 2 drinks and stop. Right? That just, that idea just makes me nervous. I just start to twitch thinking about, you know, I would rather all of you unmute yourself and start screaming obscenities at me rather than for me to be caught in a situation where I have 2 drinks in me and I can't get any more. That is truly the nightmare situation. And so I know our book is polite, and it is. Our book was written so politely in regards to men of science, men of religion, and men of medicine. You know, and they say, you know, there's no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. We were just being polite. We know that science cannot accomplish the solving of this. We know for a fact that what ails me requires a rearrangement of attitudes and ideas or a spiritual awakening. Right? If you're uncomfortable with the idea of spiritual awakening, just call it a rearrangement of attitudes and ideas that will allow sobriety. That's all it is. That's what Carl Jung described it as. Just a, I like to just call it a fundamental rearrangement of my attitude towards life at a cellular level. That's what had to happen to me. I had to completely rearrange how I viewed life, and Alcoholics Anonymous did that for me there at 25 years old, and I've been able to remain sober ever since because of that. So I'm just this stoned kid, right? I'm a stoned. I started drinking kind of late. I was 11 when I started drinking, and we lived up in Seattle, and I'm just this stoned, long-haired kid in the 70s looking for concert tickets, looking for a bottle, looking to smoke some weed. That's who I am. I'm long hair. I call my mother man. Hey, man. Mom. Woo-hoo-hoo. Right? That's my vocabulary, 14. And I had really good parents. God, they were good, good people. Really involved in their community, designed their lives to serve others, but not alcoholic. And here they got me. They got, you know, I'm just this stoned kid. And they would try to help me. But you see, they always blame my problems on people, places, and things. They thought, if we can get him away from that group of kids he's hanging out with, things will get better. If we can get him out of that public school system here in Seattle and get him into a private school, that will help. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. Fast forward, my parents try to send me off to college. I spend 3 years Washington State University and University of Washington. And in 3 years, I got 10 credits at any given time. My grade point average matched my blood alcohol content. It was just a giant waste of money on my parents' behalf. And, of course, they're so busy with their lives, and they had other kids, right, that they weren't paying attention. Right? They were busy in their own life and saying, our son's off at college, maybe he'll be all right. But after 3 years, when they realized they hadn't seen any grades, they showed up. They showed up over there, Holman, Washington, and knocked on the door at 7 a.m. And another guy I lived with opened up the door. There was 15 people in the house. I only knew about 6 of them. Right? And there's my parents. There's our son going to college, right? They yanked the carpet from underneath me at that point. A drug deal went really, really badly right about this time, so I joined the Navy. I figured 5 years down on a submarine is a good place to hide. It had really gone south for me. And what I'm about to tell you should concern you. If you care anything about the security of the United States, but on my way to the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test. And this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that even maybe possibly or even remotely would allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test is what it's called. I never knew how to study for those things. Should have been kicked out of the Navy. Series of events allowed me to stay in the Navy. They took away the 2-year nuclear school. They sent me out to the fleet. Now I'm out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on a Spruance class destroyer. We're hunting Russian submarines. It's 1984, 85, 86. And I start to learn a lot of things a young man's supposed to learn. I started to learn the camaraderie of the military. I started to understand the honor of serving my country. I started to learn a trade. But I'm alcoholic. And it doesn't matter what I might be experiencing as a young man or what I might be learning if I don't address my alcoholism. It will be taken away from me. And the problem is although I would do really well when the ship was out at sea, that ship would pull into a port and I would take a drink. And I literally, at this point in my life, I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old, and I take a drink, and I'm at this point in my life, I'm triggering off by accident 3- and 4-day drunks. Now, when I was a teenager, sometimes we would plan these 3- and 4-day runs. We would know it. We would design our lives, making up lies with whoever we needed to go on, to purposely go on these 3- and 4-day runs. Now I'm triggering these off, and I don't even know how they're starting or how to stop them. And I, you know, the military is really, really big sticklers on this show up where you're supposed to show up thing. They really are big on that. And it's a strange feeling. It's a strange feeling when I would come out of one of these 3-day drunks and I'd find myself on a large pier, 6 a.m. in the morning in a foreign country, and I'd be looking up and down that pier going, there was a destroyer here the other day. Navy gets pretty angry at this behavior, and I'm getting in a lot of trouble. I've been in the Navy approximately 2 years at this point, and I came to in a cheap motel room on a Monday morning. I'm late getting back to my ship again. I started drinking on Thursday. It's now Monday. I'm late. I hop in my car. I start racing back to the base. We're in San Diego. And it was pre-9/11, of course. This was May of 1986. It's pre-9/11. Security is high at every Navy base, but not as high as it is now. At the front of every Navy base, there's a guard shack where a Marine stands duty. And I'm racing to get back to the ship. And one of the tools for living I gained by this time is I would always save a pint for the end of the drunk. And I'd drink it on my way back to the base to try to get that last little amount of alcohol to hold me over, because I know when I get back to the base, it's going to be a while till I get a drink. And this particular morning, I'm paying more attention to that bottle than where the car is going. All of a sudden, my eyes come into focus, and the Marine in this guard shack in the front of the Navy base has his head out of the guard shack, like, and I'm wondering what he's so excited about. And I look down, I'm going 40 miles an hour. I yank the wheel, try to swerve, the car hits this median on the right hand side, this big cement median, and it flips over and bang, right through that guard shack, and I can still see that Marine doing this big dive. I mean, thank God these guys are in good shape. I am so thankful Marines are in tip-top shape. This guy dives out of the guard shack. He does a quick somersault. He's back up, weapon drawn. And it's one of those mornings. God, I hated these mornings. You know, where there's sirens going off, there's broken glass, twisted metal, people running around in various directions and all wondering what, you know, they're all screaming and yelling, and they're looking at me. And they're acting like this is all my fault. Now, on these particular mornings, it also took me a few minutes to figure out what's going on, too, right? And I hated those mornings. And then, of course, the other phase two of a bad morning means later on that day, I'm handcuffed to a hospital bed where you're injured and under arrest at the same time. That's always a bad morning, always a bad morning. That particular morning, as they were reading new charges on me, this was nothing significant, new charges. That's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called antabuse for me. I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every single morning before quarters. And I'd have to sit in a chair, and the hospital corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure the antabuse actually got in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism, and that is I had no alcohol in my system, and I was literally going insane. It's the part of alcoholism, not an alcohol problem. If when you take alcohol away from me, and you do not specifically put me into the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot be on the fringes or outside Alcoholics Anonymous looking in. I have to have one of two things active in my life. I either have to have a drink in my hand, or I have to be in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are my only two choices. Just like at the bottom of page 25, where it really poses that question to a young man like me when I was new. If you're as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. We have but two alternatives. One is go on to the bitter end, blotting out our existence as best we can, which means drink. That's one option if you're alcoholic. Nick, go ahead and drink. The other option, accept spiritual help. So to me, that means I either have to have a drink in my hand or the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are my two options. I lasted about 10 days on that antabuse. I went AWOL from my ship. That means absent without leave. Illegally leaving my ship, and I locked myself in a little motel room in downtown San Diego and had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass. And I remember sitting on the edge of this bed and on this rickety little end table. There was a bottle of that. I had that bottle sitting there with the shot glass. As I stared at the bottle of vodka, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of antabuse. They had told me, son, you need to understand that once we prescribe this antabuse for you and you have this in your system, if you drink on this, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at that bottle, I thought, well, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get. So I took one shot, and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingling in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room. I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, I was like hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are sick if you think this is funny. If you really are. It's only in Alcoholics Anonymous where you know, some guy has shot himself and he's bleeding out, but, you know, he says, but I'm hanging on to the bottle. We go, hilarious. Right? Anyway. So, I took another shot. And up it came. You know, we're all used to normal puking, right? You know, it's one of the tools for living we get. You get that little warning. You try to find a bathroom if you can. If you're driving, get the window down. We've all learned our lesson. But here on the antabuse, there's no warning. It's just, sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe, maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of antabuse, and that is if you hang in there. It's a very important aspect. If you're going to drink on top of antabuse, you cannot half measure it. If you're going to drink on antabuse, you might need to reach down deep inside yourself for a level of commitment you might not even know you have. But I found that if I kept drinking and kept puking and kept drinking and kept puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the antabuse would kick out of my system, and I'd quit throwing up, and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating, and sweating. And I'm all right with that. So I drank on top of antabuse for the last 7 months of my drinking. The only words to describe this are desperation drinking. And in that 7 months, I wound up in the hospital a couple of times, stomach pumped, you know. I love those mornings where you come out and you still got the gray around your mouth, right, from where the charcoal from pumping your stomach. And then you walk into the bar and the bartender goes, son, are you sure you need a drink? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Or you still got the iodine stain on your arm where they've been intravenously feeding you to try to hydrate you again. And you still got that orange thing in the bandage and you walk into the bar and the bartender, oh, dude. Anyway, my last night of drinking I already described to you. I was in handcuffs one more time. They wouldn't accept me on board my ship. The MPs had me in handcuffs. I'd been in handcuffs with the civilian police earlier that morning the night before. Now the military police have me in handcuffs. They try to bring me back to my ship, and the officer that put his arm up says, wrong answer. We're not to accept this loser on board. The orders are 90 days in the brig back on a discharge or treatment. I remember those handcuffs were extra tight that morning, and when they said, or treatment, I remember kind of going, And it wasn't because I thought treatment was a good idea. I just figured this treatment thing might help me with the inevitable new charges that were again coming my way. And I'm the kind of guy that gets charges when he's still not solved his previous charges. I might still have some sort of court date going on from the last one, and I'm picking up new ones. Right? And so when they said, or treatment. Now, I now know that it wouldn't have mattered what I was thinking or feeling or whether I thought it was a good idea to go to that treatment center or not because I was in handcuffs. Right? And I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever stop and say, hey, Carl, so what's your opinion on what happens next? Right? When you're in handcuffs, you go where they sit. And they took me up to a military treatment center up in the north end of San Diego at the Miramar Naval Air Station. It's actually where Top Gun pilot school used to be. Our little section was called Top Drunk. And when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off. I vividly remember that they were unwilling to take the handcuffs off me that morning until I heard the doors lock behind me. That's who I am. The country I'm supposed to be serving and the society I'm supposed to be living in is only willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors are locked behind me. That's who I am without Alcoholics Anonymous. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, the sum total of my life would have been, I would have been a real burden on the American taxpayer. And I would also be a distant look in my mother's eye when one of her friends might have accidentally brought my name up. That's who I would have been without Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead, I've had the chance to live this glorious life for the last 34 years. It's hard to even explain. So in the first few days, this military treatment center, they're doing medical checkups on us. They told me I had the liver of a 70-year-old man. Right? It was actually, my liver was extended. It had massive scar tissue. Apparently drinking on top of Anabuse does a little number on your internal organ. Who knew? And they said that I had what's called alcoholic edema. That's where the alcohol wasn't being processed by the liver, so it's entering your bloodstream as pure alcohol. And so where it sends it is into your skin. Did you know that? Right? So your skin becomes this ugly, cushy thing where if you push on it, a fingerprint will stay, and you can smell alcohol, right? I had that. I was hurting. And military treatment center during detox is not very cushy. How do you know this? But when you're in the military, you are their property. Right? You can actually get arrested for harming military property if you hurt yourself. And now they also don't care, and they don't give you a cushy detox. I don't know if anybody else has been to military treatment, but you're in detox, like 3 days in, you're running 3 miles out on the roads with Marines screaming at you, move it, move it, you're going to become a goddamn fighting man again, move it. You know, we would drop out, start vomiting on the side of the road, they'd laugh at it, right? They would, right? And then in the afternoon, they'd put us in therapy and say, how do you feel? But in the first few days, they're doing this, the medical checkups, they're trying to get our files sent from our bases or our ship or our command. And they got us in this group therapy session, right? And they got the newest counselor. He's a really new counselor who's working with us in the first couple of days. And he's giving us his all. I mean, he's really trying his best. And he's trying to get us to talk. And there's about 15 of us in there. And, you know, in this group therapy, there winds up being 35 of us in the treatment center. But there's 15 on this second or third day. We're sitting there, nobody's saying anything. And this new facilitator or counselor is getting a little antsy that nobody's talking. He's running out of things to say. Finally, late the second day or early third day, this kid from named Paco from some other base raises his hand. He goes, my name's Paco. I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to stay sober. And I want you guys to know that my real name's not Paco. Paco is just a street name I've used since I've been a young teenager, and I've always used it when things look like trouble. When I got here the other day, this looked like trouble. But you're going to find out anyway when my file arrives from my ship. My real name is Randy, so I'd like to be honest and upfront with you guys. Will you guys call me Randy? Now, this facilitator really got excited. I mean, oh my God, this is the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs. right? He got all excited. And later that afternoon, they called us together again, and they called out Randy's name. Randy, come on up front. Randy walks up front. They had made a gold name tag for him. They slapped that thing on his chest. And then we were all informed that whenever staff's not around, Randy's in charge because he's had this breakthrough of honesty that was so admirable. Randy loved his new job, right? And we all hated Randy. Now Randy's going to start turning us in if we're smoking cigarettes out the bathroom window. You know, if we're at the candy machine at the wrong hour, he's turning us in. If our beds are not made, Randy's turning us in. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Lisa was my first meeting. To my knowledge, I'd never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I imagine that members of AA had probably tried to 12-step me. I have vague memories of people talking about their drinking and they didn't drink anymore, but I don't believe I've been to a meeting before. Been in this place 7 days, and a group of white vans pulled up, and now there's 35 of us in this military treatment center, and about four white vans pull up, so seven or eight of us get in each van, and each van took off to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous out in San Diego County. And I got to tell you, I cannot tell you how grateful I am that Alcoholics Anonymous allows outside agencies to send potential alcoholics to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful that those meetings in San Diego allow the military to send potential alcoholics to go sit in the back and watch meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Saved my life. Here's the thing. Very first night I'm sitting in the back of a meeting, some guy gets up, starts telling, you know, I think it was like 3 15-minute speakers or something. And one after another, they just floored me. See, my whole life, I'd run across people that tried to help me, but they were always highly educated, well-meaning people who were paid to talk to me. I knew they were paid to be there. And they always wanted to talk to me about me. You know, son, why are you doing these things? Let's talk about what must be wrong with you that might have you do these things. You know, if I would have had the vocabulary, I would have said to these well-meaning people, I know, I get it. I see that you're shocked that I'm willing to pay this price for another drink. I get it. But I would have followed that up with this. I would have said, but if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't wonder why I drink. See, there's only one thing worse than the price I'm paying for my drinking, and that's the way that I feel when I'm not drinking. The restlessness, irritability, discontentment, frustration, that feeling of I'm completely separate from the world. And I cannot feel connected to the world without a drink. And you're going to take that away from me now too? That's all I got. That's all I've got. I'm not giving it up. But I sit there in those meetings and you guys understood that feeling. You talked about it like this was yesterday's news, that you knew all about this. It was my biggest secret, the fact that all I had left was alcohol. That was my biggest secret. I had a few other doozies too, right? Kind of like, I mean, another secret. The Navy thought I was married. I was not, right? That's a kind of big secret. You get paid extra if you're married. Anyway, I really went off the rails. There's a lot to explain there, and I'm not going to get into it. But anyway, you know, lots of other things. The fact that I owed those drug dealers back in Seattle so much money. I didn't want any of it. But you guys, I'm sitting in the back of that meeting, and you guys are telling me stories that make mine seem like child's play, right? And you didn't want to talk to me about me. In fact, you barely even knew I was there. Yeah, you asked for new people, but there's 150 people in the room, and you just kind of said, yeah, nice to, you know, yay. But you didn't get in my face and say, let's talk. Why are you doing these things, Carl? In fact, you guys just talked about yourselves rather incessantly. It's all you did was talk about yourselves. Kind of like what I'm doing tonight, right? On and on and on about me. Right? But in that, whatever there is about that, when an alcoholic tells their story, it sets something off inside me that I didn't even know was there. You know, our book, Alcoholics Anonymous calls it the identification, one alcoholic identifying with another. And a magic happens. A magic happens that happens nowhere else for us. And it happened to me. Anyway, after 45 days, they let us all out of this treatment center, just what the orders were. They're going to let us out on a Friday. And on a Wednesday, they gathered all 35 of us up, and they put us in this room. And we're all sitting there looking at each other, knowing we're going to get out in a couple of days. And all of a sudden, the side door opens up, and the biggest, meanest counselor in the place comes in. And he's a Marine, and he's in his full dress uniform. And I got to tell you, a Marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive, very intimidating sight. And he opened up the door. We saw him in his full dress uniform. And, I mean, it just went quiet. You could hear him every step he took towards this podium or lectern in front of the room. This man grabbed this podium and leaned across and stared at all 35 of us. I mean, it's quiet in that room. And he looks at us. He goes, "You 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. We've been here for many years, and our statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. But only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward." Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? But when he said that, when he said, "Only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward," man, if you thought it was quiet before, it was dead silent. Now, you could hear a pin drop in that room. The only thing you could hear was me going, "Shit." Because we all knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here. Right? By now, he's the poster boy of the treatment center, for God's sake. He's turned in term papers on acceptance with little footnotes of Dr. Paul's story. Right? Page 449. That's in the third edition, by the way. On this Friday afternoon, they're letting us all out. They're taking us back to our ship station commands in various different ways. There's a few of us that have been arrested in vehicles the night before, so we were told to be out on the front doorsteps of the military, the treatment center barracks, and our cars that have been in an impound lot, and they would be brought to us one at a time. So I'm standing out there with a few other guys, and as we're standing on the front doorsteps there, one of the guys I'm with points at this car. He's coming across the parking lot. He goes, "Whoa, is that Randy in that car?" We look, yeah, sure enough. Must have gotten out early for turning in that gold name tag or something. And as he got a little closer, one of the other guys says, "He's drinking already." Sure enough, he pulls up. He's got himself a bottle. He's polishing it off. He rolls down the window, throws the empty right at our feet, gives us all the finger, and he drives right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. The only thing I remember of that day is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up at a 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. And I started my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first couple of years of sobriety were centered out of the north end of San Diego, all the meetings up there, and out on my ship, and meetings around the world. I spent 50 to 60% of my first 2 years of sobriety out at sea or visiting various ports, anywhere from northern Alaska out to Hawaii, down to Central America. And wherever that ship pulled into port, my first sponsor, another guy on the ship, he was 23 years old, I'm 25 years old, two little knuckleheads sailing around the world, finding meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my first 2 years of sobriety. And Alcoholics Anonymous, wherever we showed up, opened up, welcomed us with open arms, and helped us in a million ways. And I got a million stories about stuff that happened out there, but we're running out of time. 2 years sober, I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That's a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God, and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. And I moved up to Covina simply to go to the university, use some VA benefits, and it was only to make amends to my parents, right? Because that, you know, that ninth step, AA keeps saying, you got to clean everything up. And my parents had wasted all that money on a bachelor's degree. I didn't have one. I either had to pay them back or go get what they paid for in the first place. And that's how I wound up in this town called Covina. And that was 32 years ago. I only meant to come here and get a degree, go back to Seattle, and I've never left. I've never left Covina, just simply because I found a home group that I can't escape. I can't escape it. You know, I'd love to tell you how wonderful and amazing it is, and it is, no doubt. But I got to tell you, if you're an active member of a home group, there's troubles too. There's struggles, but man, oh man, I got to tell you, the good far outweighs the bad, and I found a life of purpose and of meaning here. My very beautiful and amazing friend Lindsay right here, if you guys see her right there, that's an example of Covina AA right there. Pretty attractive, isn't it? She's got 5 years sober, and she reads for us for our book study that we do every Wednesday night. We got a couple of hundred people on there, about 9 or 10 different AA clubhouses, and about, what is it, Lindy? About 10 sober houses are on there. It's fantastic. And she's the best reader this side of the Mississippi. We actually heard that the person who reads on the other side of the Mississippi passed away last week, so Lindsay's the best in the country now. And we have a blast, right? I'm really proud of my home group that we instantly, in late February, early March, instantly changed over to Zoom and was able to do everything that could possibly be done with this new technology, and we're still working on it because it's not going anywhere. This Zoom thing is here to stay, I promise you, and it absolutely is opening up so many new doors for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's gonna, when we put out a new edition of the Big Book, there's going to be at least 2 pages, if not more, written about this revolution on Zoom in Alcoholics Anonymous. 2,000 years from now, they're going to look at this year, 2020, and the transformation of Alcoholics Anonymous to where we are interconnected like we have never been before. Right? And so, anyway, I'm really proud to be a part of a home group that took that seriously, and we were able to hold together. We're now back at live meetings, and we're just having a good time. And another big thing in my life is I have a 16-year-old daughter that is just, she's amazing. I have a 14-year-old son that's also just amazing. But right now, today, I'm especially impressed with my daughter. She's the varsity goalkeeper for her high school, and there's 4 teams left in the state championship playoff. 4 teams in all of California, and she's one of them. And they are fighting hard. And she is just kicking butt. And I just sit there and I cry in the stands. I literally cry. Just, I didn't know that life could mean this much. I didn't know that life could mean this much. When I say that that without Alcoholics Anonymous, all I would have been a burden to the American taxpayer and a distant look in my mother's eye. That's the sum total. Now I am getting to live everything that life has to offer. Everything that life has to offer, I have had the privilege of experiencing. And a good friend of mine on the book study said this earlier, and I'll just say it. I couldn't pay Alcoholics Anonymous back in 100 lifetimes. I could not pay Alcoholics Anonymous back in 100 lifetimes for what it's given me. If you're new or fairly new, get a sponsor, find a home group, start working steps, and then start working with others. Do those things, and I swear to you, you can stay. God bless. Thanks.